Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin, Mishkin Law in Chicago. We've really got a great show for you today. You know, this is always a tough time of year in terms of picking shows, not because they're hard to find, but because there's so many of them. Right, April and May, we always have Europe 72. The Dead just did a big box set last year, five or six shows from their spring tour of 1973. And then, of course, the spring tour of 1977, which is famous for so many reasons and so many different legs of that tour. Today, we are focusing on a show that was played 47 years ago tomorrow, April 30th, 1977, at the Palladium in New York City. It's another good show from 77. The recording quality is actually not bad, considering it's an audience recording. Yes, audience recordings, just like we had to listen to back in the day. Since then, the show has been commercially released as the first volume of the Grateful Dead Download series, if you want to hear crisper soundboard recordings. But in the meantime, enjoy the way the show started as the band walked onto stage and picked up their instruments. Never Stopped, a well-loved and popular tune composed by Robert Hunter and Bob Weir, released on Blues for Allah on September 1st, 1975. Bob had some interesting things to say about the tune, and I thought that we might want to check them out while we let that beautiful music kick in. He says, as a lyricist, I'm glacially slow. I can generally get the job done, but it takes too damn long. So I like to work with people who have a little more facility with that. You know, John Barlow, Garrett Grant, Robert Hunter. Or I may have a general notion of the color of the rhythm and the harmonic or melodic development, and I'll sit with a guy and we just fire blank verses at each other until we start to corner that color. And then often the song will fall right out of the sky. Other times, I may have no notion of where the song wants to go, in which case I'll let whoever I'm working with surprise me. The Music Never Stopped is a song that we wrote over the telephone. I had this business going, and he plays a sample guitar riff, so I played this over the phone to John, and he just started spitting stuff at me. The first line came out, there's mosquitoes on the river. Fish are rising up like birds. Now, John was living in, I apologize, I said Hunter Weir, this is a John Perry Barlow Bob Weir tune. So the story goes from Bob Weir that John Barlow was living in Wyoming at the time on a ranch, and he just started describing a situation that I'd seen with him where it was late summer on a dry year and things were hot and kind of dull and dead. So where are we going to take this? Well, first I figured the verse is going to have to be twice as long as I originally figured, because if you start with an image that thick, you have to get into some detail about it. It's been hot for 7 weeks now, too hot to even speak now. Did you hear what I just heard? The last line came out after some deliberation. It's a pregnant line, sort of like leading tone in a harmonic development. And then after going through a lot more, which you can find online if you want to really read about it, it's all there, I think, on Relics, all very good stuff. The success of the endeavor, if you're working with a lyricist, depends on how closely the lyric marries the music. With Barlow or Garrett Graham or whoever, there's a lot of back and forth, I guess. I have to be the decider because the words are going to come out of my lips, and so I have to be able to tell the story. I have to be that character because my job is to get the hell out of the way and let the character tell the story musically and lyrically. When I'm standing in front of a microphone, I may look like me, but I'm not. If the character arrives with a really defined face and features, then it's easy for me to do my job. Fun version, because almost always a first closer, and this is a fun version because it's almost always a first set closer, and here it is opening the show, which I really love because it always gets the fans up and really pumped, and then they kind of, you know, dwindle out and go off stage for an hour. And here, far from it, they just keep rolling right along, and it really has a very, very solid first set that, you know, like I say, if we had the time to get into all of it, we would. We just don't. That's the unfortunate part. But they go into a Great Bertha, It's All Over Now, Deal, Mama Tried, Me and My Uncle, Peggy O, Looks Like Rain. It's just, we just can't get it all. But we're going to get the good stuff. But The Music Never Stopped was first, 236 times it was played, first performed on August 13th, 1975. The Great American Music Hall in San Francisco, last played on June 8th, 1995 at the Palace of Auburn Hills. And we were talking about this show being at the Palladium. Now, the Palladium, originally called the Academy of Music, was a movie theater, concert hall, and finally a nightclub in New York City on the south side of East 14th Street between Irving Place and 3rd Avenue. It was designed by Thomas W. Lamb. It was built in 1927 across the street from a site of the original Academy of Music, established by financier Moses H. Grinnell in 1852. Opened as a deluxe movie palace by movie mogul William Fox, the Academy operated as a cinema through the early 1970s. Beginning in the 1960s, it was also utilized as a rock concert venue, particularly following the June 1971 closure of the Fillmore East. It was rechristened the Palladium on September 18, 1976, with the band live radio broadcast, and continued to serve as a concert hall into the following decade. In 1985, the Palladium was converted into a nightclub by Steve Rubell and Ian Schrager after their success with Studio 54. Japanese architect Arata Isozaki redesigned the building's interior for the club. Peter Gation owned and operated the club from 1992 until 1997. The Palladium closed in August 1997 following its purchase by New York University. In August 1998, the building was demolished in order to rebuild a 12-story residence hall that students affectionately refer to as Palladium Hall. The Dead also played there when it was called the Academy of Music in a series of seven shows on their way out of the country for their Europe tour in 1972. One of these shows, the entire March 28, 1972 performance, plus selections from March 25, 1972 and March 27, 1972 were released as Dick's Picks Volumes 30. The five-night Palladium run, of which today's show was the second, is famous for a lot of reasons, including part of 1977, when the Dead put together a string of some of their best shows ever, peaking on May 8, 1977, just a week later, at Barton Hall in Ithaca, New York. All five of these shows at the Palladium are well-played, great tunes, and a really grooving feel you can pick up off the CD or download 47 years later. I had most of these shows on tape and wore them out from so much playing. I love that they previously released this show as Download Series Volume 1, and the new Dave's Picks release, number 50 if you can believe it, is the May 3rd, 1977 show, including extra songs from the next night, as well as the annual Dave's Pick bonus disc, which is even more songs from the following night, May 4th. If you're not listening to Dave Picks, you are missing out on quality recordings of some of the best shows ever, and it's no coincidence that he's releasing a Palladium show right as we're featuring one, because it's that time of year. How hot was the band? Well, check out this extended version, this extended jam at the end of Mississippi Half Step, the second to last song in the first set, ending with A Great Promised Land, and be sure to listen for Jerry and Keith going back and forth throughout this clip. Mississippi Half Step, Uptown Toodaloo, a Garcia Hunter tune released on Wake of the Flood in 1973. You can find live versions of it on Steal Your Face, Dick's Picks Volume 1, Without Annette, and who knows how many other Dick's Picks, Dave's Picks releases. If you want to hear it, you can find it easily. It's just a wonderful tune. That jam at the end, though, is really special. You know, it doesn't always quite wind up jamming out that way, but this night the boys were really on it. And I love how Jerry and Keith just going back and forth with the guitar and the baby grand piano, or maybe it was a full grand piano, and it just really, really sounds awesome. This song was first performed on July 16th, 1972 at Dillon Stadium in Hartford, Connecticut. It followed Me and My Uncle and led into Sing Me Back Home, which closed out the first set and was a staple of the band's repertoire ever since. Played 236 times. You're Not Hearing Things turns out to be the exact same number of times that The Music Never Stopped was played. Go figure. You know, another one of these great Grateful Dead coincidences, or not. This one was first played on July 16th, 1972 at Dillon Stadium in Hartford, Connecticut, and was last played on July 6, 1995 at the Riverport Amphitheater in Maryland Heights, just outside of St. Louis. So we're on our way here now to a great, great show. But we're going to veer for a minute and hit just a little bit of music news, because we do have some stuff coming up that I want to talk about. R-O-C-K in the USA, subtitled The Salute to 60s Rock. It's a rock song written and performed by John Mellencamp. Kids, I remember when he was John Cougar, then John Cougar Mellencamp, and then just good old John Mellencamp. It was the third single from his 1985 album, Scarecrow, and a top 10 hit on both the Billboard Hot 100 and the Top Rock Tracks charts, peaking at number 2 and number 6 respectively. You know, it was a period piece. If you were growing up at that period of time, were listening to the radio a lot like I was, you heard this song everywhere, and you heard a lot of John Mellencamp. He really had a very strong following, was a big promoter of Farm Aid with Bob Dylan and others, and I think even Fish played one Farm Aid one year at University of Illinois Champaign in the football stadium there. And yeah, John Mellencamp was just, you know, really something. So nice pick by Dan there, great way to get into this and have a little bit of fun with the music that's swirling around out there. So we're now in week 2 post Fish in the Sphere. The stories are still coming out. Everyone had a wonderful time. The visuals were the highlight, and of course that was to be expected. Dead & Co is next, and the ball is now squarely in Dead & Co's court to pick up this amazing lighting run that Fish laid down, and see what they can put out to their legion of fans, to whom the really cool visuals when you went to a show and when they would like put a little oil in a petri dish with a little bit of water and a little bit of food dye and make them all move back and forth over each other, and everybody would sit there and just stare and go, wow. Now, actually, not I, because that was even a little before my time. When we did it, they would just have these videos that were like flashing so fast, you know, with the same little pictures repeating over and over, but like 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 of them, who knows how many. And, you know, just, and sometimes, you know, with weird colors and lines and designs, but I mean, nothing approaching what we saw, or at least I didn't, but what the people who were there saw in the Sphere for Fish. So yeah, it's going to be fun to see what Dead & Co could come up with. I am still undecided in the camp of whether I'm going to make it out there or not, given all of my Fish touring this summer and other thing that I really want to talk about today, and that's Neil Young. He has come back from wherever it was he's been hanging out recently, and he unlaunched his 2024 tour with Crazy Horse, and it's just something amazing. Rolling Stone gave a great write-up, so thank you as I kind of go through and paraphrase them. But he, prior to this show, in typical Neil Young fashion, he revealed nothing about his 2024 U.S. tour. Before it kicked off this past Wednesday night at San Diego's California Coast Credit Union Open Air Theater. Other than the fact that he'd be backed by Crazy Horse and that Mike and Nelson would be taking over guitar duties from Nils Lofgren, who it turns out is busy traveling around with Bruce Springsteen on his tour. So there you go. You got a couple of old guys 80 or close to 80 touring around. It turns out that Nils Lofgren is such a stud. He's playing for both of them. And what are the odds all of us, well, with Springsteen, he's touring all the time. But, you know, for Neil Young to get back out with Crazy Horse and put it all together, old Nils isn't available. So he reaches out to Micah Nelson. And, this turns out to be a really, really good mashup. So, as they point out in Rolling Stone, anything felt possible when the curtain dropped after a high-energy opening set by Reverend Billy and the Stop Shopping Choir, revealing the iconic oversized speaker cabinets and road cases from the 1978 Russ Never Sleeps tour. That's another iconic album for people my age. Dan Lieberman was all over it before any of us even knew it hit us. Young walked onto stage alongside Nelson. Drummer Ralph Molina and bassist Billy Tabbitt plugged an old black and launched into a hypnotic Cortez the Killer, one of my personal favorites. The band jammed out for over 6 minutes before Young sang the opening lines, igniting the crowd into a frenzy, with the big moment coming near the end when he began singing some unfamiliar words. As he teased earlier this month, it was the legendary lost segment of the song that failed to record during the 1975 Zuma sessions because the console briefly lost power. Young recently found the lyric manuscript and worked out where they originally fit in the song. I'm not even going to try to sing it for you all. You can hear it later. Probably go on YouTube and catch it already. But it was a remarkable moment to witness after 49 years and over 540 live performances. The world's finally getting to hear the song as Young originally wrote it. He followed up with a powerful Cinnamon Girl and a brief address to the audience. We made a lot of records with a guy named David Briggs, a producer. I knew him from the first record on, Young said. He was truly great. When we play, we remember what it was like when we did it. The song here is one we did right after he went to the higher place. Young was talking about Scattered, Let's Think About Living from 1996's Broken Arrow, which was the newest song they played all evening. The rest of the set was music recording when Briggs was alive, largely between 1969 and 1979. Beginning with Don't Cry No Tears, he followed it up with a triple energy shot of Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere, Down by the River, 16-minute version. It's just, I'm going just to hear Neil play Down by the River, folks, because he's coming here right at the very end of May, the Thursday before Memorial Day weekend. And we got a whole group going, thanks to good buddy Kerry, who secured the box seats, and good friends Andy and Alex will be coming in, good buddy Mike. Harold from in town is going to the show with us, and I'm forgetting somebody, but I'll think of them in a few minutes, probably, or maybe I got everybody if I include me, too. So it's quite an all-star lineup of people to be going to see an all-star rocker with, and I'll have great stories about that following that show, which, again, is the Thursday leading into Memorial Day weekend. It's going to be out at Northerly Island, which is out on Lake Michigan, and assuming we don't have one of those not-so-infrequent anymore cold May nights where the temperature can dip, especially out on the lake. Hopefully it'll be a lovely warm evening. We'll all be enjoying the Chicago skyline, whatever other treats we brought along, and the benefits of being in a box. Most notably, you have a lot of room, you got your own bathrooms, and life is good. So thanks to Kerry for pulling that down. But just so excited to go see Neil. And, you know, quite frankly, this review just goes on and on, because even the author who wrote this is just so amazed at, you know, how incredible this song was. And he writes, this is a good moment to pause and reflect on Micah Nelson, Willie Nelson's youngest son. He's been playing with Young as an honorary member of Promise of the Real for the greater part of a decade, and he got the chance to perform with the Nils Lofgren version of Crazy Horse at 3 Under the Radar Club shows last year. But this was his first time playing as the sole additional guitarist besides Young on stage, and it's a fairly difficult task since he had to replicate parts originated by Danny Whitten and Frank Pancho San Pedro. I'm going to pay tribute and honor Danny and Pancho and be true to the sound of Crazy Horse, Nelson told Rolling Stone in March. I want to bring Pancho and Danny's spirit into the space with us through me as much as I can. That's exactly what he did all night long. He was given the opportunity because, as we said, Nils was off playing with the E Street Band, but Young could not have found a better person for the job. Nelson even harmonized with Molina and Talbot on background vocals, like this is something they had been doing for years. By the way, Molina is 80 years old and basically looks and sounds like he did when he was 40. Teams of scientists need to study him and figure out how this is possible. After the Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere mini set, the quartet Crazy Horse 4.0, they wonder, kicked into one of the most greatest renditions of Powderfinger ever, thanks to improvisational guitar work prior to each verse by Young and Nelson. What came next was a 16-minute Love and Only Love, the band's walking off stage and Young strapping on a harmonica rack for solo acoustic renditions of Comes a Time, Heart of Gold, and Human Highway that had the entire amphitheater singing along. The band returned to wrap up the night with Don't Be Denied, an autobiographical tale that carries a lot more emotional weight when Young sings it at age 78 as opposed to 28. And a thrashed out Hey, Hey, My, My into the black sent everybody out after a nostalgic night of Crazy Horse that completely neglected the 18 albums Young has released since the turn of the millennium. And nobody could possibly expect him to perform at this level of intensity and passion at this point in his life. And yet here he was. So Neil Young rocking it the way it's supposed to be. And very excited to see him out at North Hurley Island at the end of May. We'll be doing a lot of talking about Neil and a lot of talking about that show leading into it and afterwards. Because, as I say, a legendary showman on stage and a legendary group of music fans all gathered together. And anybody who's going to be in Chicago and wants to swing by North Hurley Island and, you know, check it out, Carrie will be signing autographs before the show, but he's the only one. Now we are going to turn our attention back to 43 years ago tomorrow, and 47 years ago tomorrow, and dive right back in. So let's pick up a little bit with where we're at. Now we are, the first set is long gone. We finished that up. And so now the boys are getting ready to rock off into the second set. And how does the second set work? Well, they started with a good, great Scarlet Fire. This is one of the first ever Scarlet Fires. The first one had only been played about a month before. And in fact, the night before, the first night of this five-show Palladium run, on April 29th, they played a Scarlet without Fire in the middle of the second set, which, you know, was probably one of the last times they ever did that. And then this night they go and they pick up the Fire, and it's just a great version of that. They go into a wonderful mid-set, Good Lovin', which is just absolutely fun because Good Lovin', typically, at least in my experience, was always an end of the night or a sometimes potentially an encore tune. And, you know, as an alternative to Sugar Mag when it would close out the set and send everybody home with a smile, a tremendous friend of the devil, which we all love, a great estimated prophet. And then they blow the doors off the place with a St. Stephen, not fade away, Stella Blue, St. Stephen sandwich that has to be heard in full to be truly appreciated. It's pretty awesome to hear. We're going to get to it in 1 second. Once they went from Stella Blue back into St. Stephen, an unusual pairing to say the least. The boys close out with Saturday Night and then yet another 1977 Terrapin Station encore, the initial year for the tune, getting a big features there before it kind of settles into its permanent place, which was more or less second set leading in to the drum solos. What we're going to do here now is we're going to play, we're going to try and touch on all of the four parts of the sandwich, and we're going to start off with St. Stephen, which always is a classical dead tune. So here is St. Stephen kicking off this wonderful stretch 47 years ago tomorrow. Thank you. Saint Stephen, blah, blah, blah. Everybody knows about it. One of the Dead's most popular tunes. I saw it. One Arm Larry didn't. That's just the way it is when it comes to Dead shows. You're either there or you're not. Again, for you fish heads, this would be the Dead's version of Fluffhead, apparently. You know, never played when you want it to be played. When it is played, it gets a totally crazy response. You could hear the opening notes there. The fans are going wild, and this is a point in time when the song was still being played with a reasonable amount of regularity. In fact, it was getting closer to the end of its life before its very brief three-show hiatus in 1983 in October at Madison Square Garden up in Hartford, and then finally out in San Rafael for the last time ever. The band would play another 12 years and never pull the tune out one more time. Disappointing, I suppose, but certainly their prerogative, and we know this. But because of it had its birth in Primal Dead, right? It was part of the original Primal Dead suite of tunes that would be Dark Star into St. Stephen, into the 11, and into a Pigpen-led crazy rap of Turn On Your Love Light. And you know, really that's where it was. It was kind of inextricably part of all of that. And yet, because of its, you know, really true melodic nature and its strong lyrics, and just because, you know, the Dead fans picked up on it, it existed long, long outside and after the end of Primal Dead, and yet, interestingly, still only played a total of 187 times. It was first played on May 24th, 1968 at the National Guard Armory in St. Louis, Rah Rah hometown, and it was last played on October 31st, 1983 at Marines Veterans Memorial Auditorium in San Rafael. Post-Dead hiatus here, they started, at any rate, that was the last time that was played, and you know, it was very, very sad, really, because it's just such a wonderful tune, and we all loved it. But this was kind of fun, because starting end of 75 into 76, the post-Dead hiatus year, they started making song sandwiches in the second set. Often based around St. Stephen. This four-song sandwich that we're featuring today at the end of the show is so good, like I say, that I had to feature all of it at the expense of, you know, a lot of these other good tunes. It's just too, you know, really too cool or too ignore to not give it its proper due. So we heard St. Stephen kind of kicking things off, and here is the first layer change as we venture out of St. Stephen and into another classic, Not Fade Away. That's just a great switch out of a really kind of trippy St. Stephen and into just an amazing opening jam of Not Fade Away. I wanted to try and catch the opening lyrics, but this opening jam went on for almost 4 minutes, which is too long for us even with these extended clips. But another reason why you need to download this show, get it archived, or, you know, download it from the Dead or wherever you can get your hands on it. And you just have to listen to this entire sandwich all the way through, because we are not doing it justice. And we're going to pick it up again in a minute, but I want to make sure that I have a little bit of time here today to talk about our other great interest, which of course is things going on in the world of marijuana. Dan, what do you got for us there?
Really, I don't care, I'm a millionaire. You smell the cookie smoke, go out in the air burning. Really don't smoke like me. I don't really share. Really don't smoke like me. 20 joints in the air. Really don't smoke like me.
Yes, sir, that is Burner, the co-founder and CEO of Cookies, the premier cannabis brand with over 70 retail locations across six countries. In 2021, Cookies was the first cannabis brand ever named by Adage as one of America's hottest brands. And in 2022, Burner became the first cannabis executive on the cover of Forbes magazine. Go back and jam on it, and hats off to Dan, always coming up with something cool. We're not just even got lyrics, man. We got this guy, who was the rapper and said, hey, I want to have my own brand, and started out as Girl Scout Cookies, but after he got a cease and desist from the Girl Scout organization, they just took off the Girl Scout part and just called themselves Cookies, and everybody knows who they are now, and just really, really great stuff. So that's always a lot of fun, and appreciate Dan taking the time to pull these things together for us so we can have a little bit of fun in the transition. But let's start off with marijuana news. And once again, fans, we have one of our favorite states, Kansas, sticking its nose kind of in the legislature where it doesn't belong. And it turns out, thank you to Marijuana Moment, by the way, for this great content. The Kansas Senate has rejected a motion to revive a medical marijuana legalization bill after a GOP member forced a vote on the issue. The chamber struck down the motion to take up the bill from Senator Robert Olson in a 12-25 vote on Friday. This comes weeks after a legislative committee shot down a separate medical cannabis pilot program bill. The legislation Olson sought to bring up, Senate Bill 135, was shelved by a legislative panel a year ago amid pushback from law enforcement. Senator Cindy Holscher, a Democrat, was among those who voted in favor of the proposal on Friday, and she said that over the past 3 weeks, scores of Kansans have reached out to their senator voicing support for medical cannabis, as they have done for nearly the past decade. Sadly, supporters have faced many hurdles on this important measure time and time again, she said. Today, we've been given a unique opportunity to move this measure forward, which is supported by a majority of Kansans. Olson previously backed medical marijuana legalization and said last October that Senate and President Ty Masterson, a Republican, removed him as a chair of a Senate committee after he held the hearings on the issue. The senator said at the time he believed it was a retaliatory move. The measure in its current form would legalize and regulate medical marijuana in Kansas with products taxed at 10%. Amazingly, much significantly lower than Illinois and California and other places, man. That's not bad. The industry would be overseen by regulators at the State Department of Revenue, Division of Alcoholic Beverage Control, which would be renamed the Division of Alcohol and Cannabis Control. Patients and caregivers would all need to register through the state's Department of Health and Environment, with patients paying a $50 registration fee and caregivers $25. Again, a lot less than what we pay in Illinois. All fees or fines collected as part of the program would be routed to a new medical cannabis registration fund to cover costs related to administration and enforcement. Physicians would need to obtain a state certificate in order to recommend medical marijuana. The state's Board of Pharmacy, meanwhile, would establish guidelines for dispensary reports and tracking. A pharmacist seeking to work as consultant for a dispensary would need to pay a $100 registration fee, probably a lot less than what they're going to be able to charge. Financial institutions working with state legal businesses would be shielded from criminal liability under Kansas law, and the bill would allow state-licensed marijuana companies to do business with Native American tribal marijuana entities. Now, after the Senate committee shelved Senate Bill 135 last year, Governor Laura Kelly issued a statement urging the public to contact their representatives to demand that they take the legislation back up for action. Kelly, who has long championed cannabis reform, said at the time that she was disappointed that some legislatures are saying they don't want to move forward with legalizing medical marijuana this year, effectively turning their backs on our veterans and those with chronic pain and seizure disorders. Olson's motion to revisit Senate Bill 135, filed earlier this month, came about a week after Kansas lawmakers shelved another medical marijuana bill, Senate Bill 555, which would have created a limited pilot program in the state. That measure envisioned a maximum of 4 vertically integrated medical marijuana companies statewide, and it would have also allowed pharmacies to dispense medical marijuana. But even that was not going to be good enough. So at the time, we have the Kansas Bureau of Investigation Director, Tony Mativa, says his agency is strongly opposed to the proposal. Now, as you can tell by the tone of my voice, you know he's about to say, I'm going to quote him saying something incredibly stupid. And here's what Director Mativa had to say. I'm very concerned by some of the trends and the data we've seen as we look around the country at other states that have legalized, he said, arguing counter to most evidence that state-level reform is associated with increased rates of opioid overdoses. He also claimed legalization would open the door to organized crime that the agency doesn't have the resources to manage. The Kansas Chamber of Commerce also opposed the bill, with President Aaron Wright warning that extreme limitations on medical cannabis in this bill are going to hurt people more than they help. Gee whiz, Aaron, thank you so much for that totally paternalistic point of view. So what you're saying, even if there's a few people who might be helped, that you're still not going to do it because there's going to be other people who are going to be hurt. So, you know, we can't run the risk of anybody being helped and letting people maybe figure out for themselves, notwithstanding the fact that what you say is a lie. You're the same state that said that people in the state didn't really understand what it meant to have medical cannabis, notwithstanding that your state, I believe, polled somewhere in the high 50 to low 60% of voters who were in favor of legalized marijuana, and yet we all get fed the same tired claptrap that everybody believes that it's a non-starter. Don't forget Masterson, the Senate president, said late last year he was open to discussion about limited medical marijuana program, but in January he appeared less open to the idea, calling medical legalization a non-starter and suggesting the policy change could lead to a surge in gang activity and put kids at risk. Okay, well, let's see. We've got about 30 states out there that now have adult use and another 10 or 15 that have medical. So I'd like somebody to please come in and show me the statistics that show that in any of those states there's been a corresponding surge of gang activity, whatever that means. Usually it's a code word for suggesting unruly persons of color, young males running around and trying to hurt and kill people and sell crack and heroin to, you know, first graders. Here's our friend Masterson again. At the time, he also suggested voters didn't understand medical marijuana. I think what people see when they think of medical, they're thinking of, you know, palliative care and things like that, Masterson said. No, they're not, right? He helped kill the House proposed bill in 2021. He's downplayed popular support and, again, suggests voters don't understand the policy change. If you look at that question, I think most people would answer yes, but they don't know what they're really saying yes to, the president said. Masterson nevertheless maintains that he remains open to discussing the topic. Masterson needs to go jump in the lake because this guy is a fool. He's an idiot. He's like a Karen in disguise, quite frankly, telling us all what we know or don't know about marijuana, about medical marijuana, and he's a guy who probably ran out of the room in college when somebody lit up a joint. Not that there's anything getting up with running out of the room, but don't come back later, 30, 40, 50 years, however old he is, and try to pretend like you really know what you're talking about. I think the real truth is, Senator Masterson, is that you don't really know or understand what true medical marijuana is, so that when you see it in action, it freaks you out because not everybody is taking it in a doctor's office with a pill. Some people smoke it. Some people eat it. Some people drink it. Some people take it like Rick Simpson oil in a black, gooey, tarry mass. People take it all different ways, through skin patches. You can think of all different ways that people take it. So, you know, the truth is, Senator Masterson, stop. Just stop talking. Let your state move forward and join the 21st century. Let your state actually bring relief to the people in your state that have overwhelmingly declared that they want it. And for God's sakes, please stop acting like you know more than everybody else. Hint, you don't. Okay, moving along, and now over to a story from our friends at MJ Biz Daily. Thank you to them, as always, both Marijuana Moment and MJ Biz, the leaders in providing marijuana content for those who want to know what's going on. And we had a little bit of chaos in New York last week. It was kind of took a chaotic roller coaster ride after a state Supreme Court judge on Wednesday struck down nearly all regulations for the market, only to issue a revised, much narrower ruling one day later. Last year, Leafly Holdings sued New York's Office of Cannabis Management, challenging the state's ban on third-party advertising for cannabis retailers on free speech grounds. But in a scathing ruling dated April 3rd that began to circulate on this past Thursday, Albany Supreme Court Judge Kevin Bryant called the laws regulating adult-use marijuana in New York unconstitutionally vague. The OCM offered a complete lack of justification for its own laws, wrote Bryant, who struck down nearly all of the statutes regulating the state's industry. However, late Thursday, Bryant issued a much narrower ruling. When the later decision was posted to the court docket Friday morning, Bryant declared that the ban on third-party advertising was null and void and arbitrary and capricious. In a brief statement emailed to MJ Biz on Friday, a spokesperson for the OCM said that regulators are reviewing the decision and exploring all possible legal options. The fluid situation sowed confusion among licensed marijuana operators and applicants still struggling to open in the state-regulated their state-regulated businesses. It also delivered yet another blow to the industry's teetering confidence in state regulators, whose rollout of an adult-use market has been described as a disaster by Governor Kathy Hochul. And she should declare it a disaster, and quite frankly, she can't escape any of the blame either. She's as much of a player in this thing as anybody else. She's the governor. She needs to step up to the plate, and she needs to take responsibility for what's going on. They need to just go back to the drawing board and get this going, because there's no reason for Missouri to be up and running in 87 days, for Illinois to take forever, and then for New York to make Illinois look like it's Missouri. It's just that bad. But guess what, folks out on the East Coast, you know, New York, while you're screwing around, one of your fellow states out there, Massachusetts, is kicking your ass, because their adult-use marijuana sales just topped $6 billion since their launch. Marijuana adult-use retailers sold more than $6 billion in products since the program launched in 2018. Combined with medical marijuana sales, the total number is about $7 billion as of August 17th, according to Spectrum News One. This past 420 set a single-day sales record at $8.5 million, according to a Cannabis Control Commission news release. I continue to be encouraged by these sales milestones because they show that the industry is strong and efficiently regulated, both spurring economic development and critical tax revenue for the Commonwealth and providing safe, tested products for consumer and patients alike, CCC Acting Chair Ava Calander Concepcion said in a statement. Meanwhile, the CCC published the final version of its Model Host Community Agreement and updated guidance documents relative to licensures and HCAs. The CCC agreed in December to overhaul the state's marijuana delivery rules by easing its two-person requirement. With a wave of new statutory and regulatory changes beginning to take shape in Massachusetts, I am confident our industry is well positioned to continue adapting, expanding, and creating more equity-driven pathways for individuals pursuing their entrepreneurial and career aspirations, Concepcion said. To that end, after many delays, the state last week launched its social equity fund to support small marijuana businesses. The program is funded by cannabis excise and sales tax. So here's a state, much smaller, they seem to be getting it right. They don't seem to be having nearly as much problems as New York, as Illinois, as some other states that just can't seem to get out of their own way. You might ask, why? I can't tell you, because I ask the same thing. This is insane. I love that Massachusetts is doing so well. It's a very cool place. A lot of deadheads live in Massachusetts. A lot of great Massachusetts rock. If you look at the days of Aerosmith and some of the other great bands that cycled out of there from back in the day. It's just hard not to be so much surprised at Massachusetts and their success, but that at New York, a state located out in the same part of the world, supposedly the international leader for our country and for most of the world. Hats off to Massachusetts, hats off to, how well they're doing in their state. And it's just nice to see that they've managed to get it right the same way Missouri's managed to get it right. And what can I say? Stay the hell away from Kansas till they, get rid of these idiots, Masterson and the governor, who just go around embarrassing themselves and you know, really insulting the intelligence and overall knowledge of the people in the state that they are voted upon to represent. And when they can't even get basic facts right, and more than that, speak against what is known as the truth, they're doing a major disservice to everyone. And I would urge the voters of Kansas to seriously take a look at that the next time either one of these individuals comes up for a vote for re-election. Not that you're going to listen to me or vote strictly on marijuana, but if you do, that's what I would do. So we're going back to our show from 47 years ago tomorrow, night two of the five-night Palladium run. And we've been in the middle of our four-song sandwich, kind of closing out the second set. And check out this next transition that they pull off seamlessly as they go from Not Fade Away into Stella Blue. Just so beautiful how they downshift on cue from the raucous Not Fade Away into that gentle and beautiful ballad mode that's required for Stella Blue. Jerry's voice is so strong and really clear. It's just a treat to hear. And for the savvy deadhead, who maybe had seen a few of these types of shows already, they might be able to deduce that leaving an unfinished St. Stephen and an unfinished Not Fade Away and into a beautiful Stella Blue might somehow ultimately make its way back to where this whole damn thing started. And of course it does. We're not even going to get to the last tune from this show, the encore for our outro today. We don't have enough time because we had to close the episode with the final transition sandwich from Stella back in to, once again, the very immediate upbeat St. Stephen that is so strong. I told Dan we could not edit any of it. He rolled his eyes. Hopefully I'm going to get my way. We'll find out in a minute. What a great, almost ending to such a great show. That, like you say, they went on to play one more Saturday night and then the Terrapin Encore, which was so very popular very early on here before it got tucked into the second set. And, you know, that has walked out of this show knowing that there was still three more to go. Like nothing like going to bed and being told right as you're going to bed the next day is a snow day. That's the feeling when you're walking out of a great show like that and you know you're going to see him again tomorrow night or, you know, three more nights out of the next four. And the people who did just got treated better and better each night. The boys went off to Europe and the rest is history. So thank you all for listening this week. Please be sure to join us next week when I will be joined by Rob Bleetstein of Grateful Dead Radio. He's the show host there whenever they're playing any of their shows out of the vault. Rob's always the one to introduce them. Rob also works with Pearl Jam and Pearl Jam Radio, and he's also the curator an archivist for the New Writers of the Purple Sage. He is joining us next week to discuss, among other things, the newly released New Writers live album, Hempstetter. If you haven't heard it yet, check it out. It was featured in Relics. I'm looking forward to hearing from Rob and how this was all put together and what the New Writers of the Purple Sage are up to these days. Does the release of the album possibly foretell a tour by these guys? And if so, what might it look like? So be sure to tune in for that. It's going to be a great show. We had Rob on the show once before. He's a great guest and knows as much about what's going on with the Dead as anybody, as long as being an aficionado on Pearl Jam and the aforementioned New Writers. We are very excited to have him on the show. I also want to give a shout-out to everyone who was either just at Jazz Fest this past weekend, those who are still there and getting ready to enjoy the days between, and those that are getting ready to roll down there to roll into this coming weekend, when, of course, as we all know, in just a few nights, Thursday night, the Rolling Stones lead off the second weekend of Jazz Fest, and apparently they expect it to be so large that all of the other stages are going to be shut down. It's going to be a Jazz Fest exclusive. Only the main stage with the Rolling Stones will be the only one that will be open and operating during the Rolling Stones set, as if you really had to convince a whole bunch of people not to go see another band when they could see the Rolling Stones, and as if, even if you could, how much nicer would it be to siphon off a few thousand or maybe even 10,000 to go scatter and see the others and give the folks seeing the Rolling Stones a chance to breathe. But I don't run Jazz Fest. Nobody asked me about it. And so everybody who's down there is having a good time. I'm giving a shout-out to my good buddy JT. Rick and Ben are there. Marnie is there. Awell and Andy were just there. Andy might even still be there. Who knows? Everybody's having a great time at Jazz Fest. Unfortunately, I didn't make it this year, but I'm sure that my wife and I will be venturing back down to New Orleans for Jazz Fest in the very, very near future. I also want to give a birthday shout-out to very good buddy Sam, who is turning, he's just turning old tomorrow on the 30th. At his age, the actual number doesn't matter, but we love him anyway. I probably shouldn't say that because I'm not really all that far behind him. But once you get to this age, anybody who's older than you, boy, you can have a good time giving shit to them. That's all I can tell you. So here we go, folks. We're going to take you home with the final transition of this amazing sandwich where we take Stella Blue back into St. Stephen for the closer. I hope everyone has a great week. Enjoy yourselves. And as always, please enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Thanks, everyone. Talk to you next week on the Deadhead Cannabis Show.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
I'm Josh Kincaid, capital markets analyst and host of your cannabis business podcast, The Talking Hedge, and newest member on PodConX. So come on over and check out The Talking Hedge. We talk about business news, interviews, investments, events, all that stuff. So come nerd out with me over at The Talking Hedge. You can find me at thetalkinghedgepodcast.com or on all your favorite podcast platforms. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe, or don't, and I'm out.